Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Promising Alternatives, presented by John DeGraff, disc number DEJ-2005-03.
I guess if you are still here today or have been to other sessions and are still here, then you genuinely think that time poverty is a real problem in our society, and you're willing to, if you're willing to tolerate listening to me, you probably think that we need to do something about it and ought to do something about it. This problem of overwork, of overscheduling, of time poverty, of an ever faster way of life, I think is a problem, the major problem that our society does not really acknowledge, as much as people may feel it personally. It's what you might call a socially sanctioned addiction. It's as if society said to you, come on, smoke, keep going. I mean, smoke more. And I kind of think that we really ought to have at the doorway of our workplaces little signs. Not understanding that work is very important to our lives, and I never want to suggest otherwise. I think work gives our lives meanings, and in some kind of moderation is very important. But when things become totally out of balance, it's a different issue. And we need a little sign on the workplace when you enter that says, caution, overwork may be hazardous to your health, kind of like the thing for smoking. A majority of Americans today, according to polls, say that they would be willing to trade some salary, some pay, and it's differing amounts, everything from 5% to 20%, for some time off work each week. Nearly 60% of Americans say that they experience stress from overwork. More than a third say that they feel continually stressed in their jobs and in the workplace. And only 23% actually say that the weekend does them any good. That by the time they come to work on Monday, they feel refreshed and ready to start the week again. Only 23%. The rest probably would rather celebrate St. Monday, which we talked about yesterday. I would say, marginless, in that a book that I would certainly suggest for people is this wonderful book called Margin. Has anybody seen it or read it? It's a very Christian perspective on the whole issue of overload in our lives. And it's written by a doctor named Richard Swenson, who practices medicine, or used to practice medicine, in Menominee, Wisconsin. He's now become such a popular writer and speaker that he doesn't have any time to practice medicine anymore. He regularly speaks to church groups and asks people to, you know, whether they think Jesus would have worn a beeper, and whether, you know, they could imagine him being beeped out of the Last Supper, for example. But the interesting thing is that I first became acquainted with Dr. Swenson and with his book through the group Focus on the Family, which might come as a surprise to some of you. It certainly did to me. I was working on a film, which later became Affluenza, and I went to Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs and spent some time talking to people there about the impact of materialism on family life. And one of the things they pointed me to was this book and this author, Dick Swenson, who actually speaks a lot for groups and things that they set up. Now, it's interesting, having met Dick Swenson, I'm sure that he has some stressful moments himself in dealing maybe with some of the ideas in Focus on the Family, but because he's, I would say, anything but a hardline evangelical conservative. Nonetheless, they like his work and they talk about it consistently. Dick Swenson kind of defines margin as this space between having comfort, balance, and enough in our lives and having overload and overpressure. He says marginlessness is being 30 minutes late to the doctor's office because you were 20 minutes late getting out of the bank, because you were 10 minutes late dropping the kids off at school, because the car ran out of gas two blocks from the gas station and you forgot your wallet. Margin, on the other hand, is having breath left at the top of the staircase, money left at the end of the month, and sanity left at the end of adolescence. Marginless is the baby crying and the phone ringing at the same time. Margin is grandma taking the baby for the afternoon. Marginlessness is being asked to carry a load 5 pounds heavier than you can lift. Margin is a friend to carry half the burden. Marginless is not having time to finish the book you're reading on stress. Margin is having the time to read it twice. Marginlessness is fatigue. Margin is energy. Marginless is red ink. Margin is black ink. Margin is less is hurry. Margin is calm. Marginless is anxiety. Margin is security. Marginless is the disease of the new millennium. And margin is its cure. And the book just came out in second edition last year, and it's really a terrific Christian perspective on this whole issue that I highly recommend. Now, most of us tend to see this whole issue of overwork and time poverty very much as a personal problem. What's the matter with me? I've got all this kind of thing. I never seem to be able to get done the things I need to get done. It's a personal problem. And in response, our bookstores are really filled with self-help books about time management. And most of them are, have anybody seen some of these books? Yeah. What do they tend to be about?
How to do things faster.
How to do things faster. How to, in fact, be more efficient so you can do more. Even more things. The problem why you can't do all these things is you're just not efficient enough. So you need to do them faster.
The theme in those books seems to be that there's something wrong with you because you can't get everything done.
Because you can't get everything
you
done.
You need to fix about yourself.
Yeah. That's right. You need to
it's
fix something
fault
about
that
yourself.
You can't do everything.
And this is the message always. You know, if you're just a little more efficient, if you just have the right, you know, set of software, or you have this or you have that, you'd be able to do it. Cecile Andrews, who some of you may know, a woman who writes a lot about the issues of voluntary simplicity and actually started the voluntary simplicity study circles movement around the country, told me that she recently went into a Kinko's store to have something printed, and they had a phenomenally huge banner and poster on the wall, and all it said was, do more. And I've seen some, I just got a thing from Microsoft in my mail, and it was the same kind of thing. The message was just do more, and you can do more if you have this particular thing from Microsoft. How many of you were here when I showed that first clip from the film Running Out of Time, where there was an ad for cellular phones and about how you could buy time? People were all, there was a kind of a time, there was a bank, Time Are Us, and people were lined up in their cars going through the bank asking to buy quality time and family time and all these things. And so the ad said you actually can buy time, but then it said, does anybody remember, and I wouldn't suspect anyone, but does anybody remember what it said, what kind of time it said you could buy? It says you can buy time. And then it says extra working time from US West Cellular. In other words, if you have this phone, you have this kind of stuff, you'll be able to do even more work. You know, you're already kind of going nuts because of this, but if you have this, you won't be able to buy time to relax, buy time to spend with your family, buy time to read a good book or do art or take part in spiritual activity, worship, any, but you could have more working time. That seems to be the message. I want to show a little clip, very short clip here, a video that kind of humorously illustrates this message that we ought to be doing more all the time. The term here is mentioned is polyphasing. This film was made in the mid-90s. And we now call, what they call polyphasing, then we now call multitasking. Being able to do, kind of balance a lot of things at once. So hopefully this will show up well on screen.
One characteristic of convergent personalities is polyphasing, or doing several things at the same time. Some people become very adept at this.
Let me demonstrate, for example, how a jogger can do a lot of things besides jogging. The well-equipped jogger these days wears a Walkman, uses a drink helmet with soft drink piped into his mouth, and simultaneously squeezes a fist exerciser, doing three things at once besides jogging: exercising, drinking, and listening. All at the same time.
Better yet, if you shave both sides of your face at once, you can shave about a minute out of every day, which would save you about 360 hours over an average lifetime.
Somewhat exaggerated, but I would argue that this is, in some ways, the kind of messages that we're getting out there. That if you just figure out this particular trick or that particular trick, you can really do it all. And so we all feel like we have this personal problem of not being able to get things done. And I would argue that if 2/3 of a society has the same personal problem, then you might want to consider that a social problem and think about whether there might be some social things that we can do about it. And I'm going to talk about the personal things today, but I want to mention that this has come out of a national campaign called Take Back Your Time, and I'll tell you just a tiny bit about how that campaign got started. It got started through the Voluntary Simplicity Movement, actually, where we have an organization called the Simplicity Forum, which is kind of a think tank, if you will, for the voluntary simplicity movement. And as we were meeting together, we were feeling often that we needed some kind of public policy component to our work, that simplicity wasn't for everybody just doing it on their own, that in fact there were things we could do as a society to make society more simplicity friendly. We all thought, too, that in order to kind of get our message out about why people ought to simplify, that we had to get away from messages that were purely about sacrifice. You need to do it because you're wasting the earth, or, you know, those things are true, but they don't seem to work. People just kind of ignore them. They think, you're guilt-tripping me, leave me alone. So the argument that we wanted to make is that you're sacrificing now in this current lifestyle, and the one thing that people are sacrificing tremendously is time. In the rush to produce all the stuff and to live the American dream of consumption, we're sacrificing time. And then we wanted to figure out how can we get that message out and get that talked about. And that's when the idea came up in 2002 about trying to create a day that people would actually talk about this issue in their communities, in their workplaces, and so forth. And a young Canadian sociologist, Anders Hayden, came up with the idea that we schedule that day 9 weeks before the end of the year to symbolize the fact that Americans are working about 9 weeks each year longer than Western Europeans. So we looked for a Friday 9 weeks before the end of the year, and that Friday happened to be October 24th in 2003, which was when we held the first Take Back Your Time Day event. About 6 months later, we found out, pure serendipity, I guess, that October 24th also happens to be the anniversary of that day back in 1940 when the United States first officially got the 40-hour work week. Could have been any one of 365 days, but it happened to be the exact day, so we decided to keep it at that day and to encourage various sorts of activity. Our motto was the first Earth Day. How many of you remember that? A lot of you were around for that first Earth Day.
Thank you.
Pardon?
I said thank you. Our age.
Yeah. April, I participated in the first Earth Day, and it really meant a lot to me. It was April 22nd, 1970. There were about 20 million people who took part in activities, forums, teach-ins, musical events, all kinds of things around the country, trying to call the attention of the society to the problems of the environment and what we were doing to our environment. And the one thing that we found was that within 3 years of that first Earth Day, we had the passage of all the most significant environmental legislation in U.S. history. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, now an endangered act, but the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, which created the EPA, all of these signed into law by a conservative Republican president, Richard Nixon, who might not have done that except for this huge catalyst, this powerful expression of public opinion that came about through Earth Day. So we had this sort of vain hope that maybe we could have something like Earth Day with a time day and call this crisis, which I think really is a crisis in our society, to public attention. Well, it hasn't quite worked like that. And the first time day was, we had about 200 events around the country, but they were all pretty small. But it is growing, and we are attracting some media attention. And we are trying through the campaign to get people to address this issue at all levels, from the very personal level to your workplace, to cultural institutions, and finally to the public policy level, which I will talk about tomorrow. So, but today I do want to talk about what people are doing and can do at a personal level to find more time, to find more margin. And so I want to first turn it open to you and just ask if any of you who have tried things to give yourself more time, what kind of things you might have tried, and whether it's worked for you. So please, anybody. Yes, Mike.
Not sharing one job.
Okay, cool. I'll write these ideas up on the board too. Okay. So job sharing is an idea. Anybody else here try? Let's try job sharing. How did it work, Michael?
Well, some of the time it worked wonderfully well. Other times, because of outside circumstances, it was impossible, and we just realized that we worked full time. And now we're sharing one position, and we're not doing a very good job of it.
How's that?
Well, we're working more than, say, 27 hours a week
each. Okay. And is it easy to persuade an employer that they should let you do a job share?
Well, I've shown a number of people, as I was working the job I had, nobody wanted it.
Nobody wanted your job. So there's nothing to share.
No.
Yeah, I'm probably in that.
In our case, it was a pastoral position, and the challenge was in three cases, who's really the boss?
Ah. So you were going to job share, but you couldn't figure that one out. Okay. What are some other things that people have tried? John?
I started leaving at 4 o'clock. Kind of leaving the office at 4 p.m. And our culture in our office is people stay fairly late. Most of them start late and leave late. And I started early and would end up staying late because everybody else was staying late. So I decided, no, I'm just leaving at 4 o'clock. And it's, you know, I got to be disciplined about it, but it's really made a difference at home.
Made a good difference at home. What about at the job? What happened?
There probably was very little impact in terms of what I missed.
They were okay, but they were okay with it too, and you didn't get a lot of pressure to stay on, or your work, or yourself.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm in a partnership in a firm, but there was some pressure to stay around. You know, people are, well, you weren't here at 4:30 to talk to me, but you just sort of ignore it.
Anyone else? Yes.
I don't own a television.
Don't own a TV. Okay. So, no TV, that's definitely a safe serve, a time sink there, because we certainly spend a lot of lot of time in front of the TV. How has your life changed, or did you never own a TV, or how has your life changed since you gave one up?
I stopped owning a TV about halfway through college, and I've just found that I have more time to read and do art projects and spend time with friends. And one thing I really like is that when I do get together with friends, we don't sit around in a circle and act as if we're going to talk and then just watch the TV. We are forced to communicate, and I just find that people can share so much more together if there's not a TV for everyone to sit and stare at.
Has there been any downside at all?
Not anything really important.
I find out we have a television, we haven't turned it on in years, but find out that it's amazing how much conversation has to do with what's on television.
That's what I hear from certain people is the downside, that they don't have the TV and then everybody at work is talking about this. This thing took place on, you know, this show and that show, and do you know what's going to happen to Susie next, and you know, and and so people feel a little left out, but I'm glad that you don't have that experience. Yes, John?
We got rid of our TV about 15 years ago, and the thing that I find that people talk about is the advertisements. Then they always look at me and they say, oh, that's right, you haven't seen this because you don't have a TV. They're kind of laughing. But we don't really miss anything.
What a thing to miss.
Yeah. But that's really what they talk about.
Talk about advertisements. Yeah. Let me get right to it. This brings up this whole thing about advertising. Has anybody seen, since none of you watch TV, I'm sure none of you have, but in case one of you might have snuck a peek while at someone else's home, has anybody seen the ad campaign? There's a little ad campaign that's come out recently. I've actually only seen one. There's three ads. I've only seen one of them. I caught it. My son and I have one TV program that we like to watch together, which is Jeopardy. And he really kind of likes, he gets all the sports questions right. So I saw one of these ads on the Jeopardy show. And in the ad, there's a fellow dressed up sort of as a corporate executive, and he's in a boardroom. With a boardroom behind him, and he sort of looks at you and says, on behalf of corporate America, I would like to thank you, the American workforce, for giving up your weeknights and your weekends and your family time and your vacations to work longer than ever before. Thank you very much, American workforce, for understanding that your time is our money. And then it doesn't say even who the ad is for. All that flashes on the screen is a little web address, www.iwantmyvacation.com. And if you go to this website, you find that it's Disney. That Disney is sponsoring this thing on TV, telling us how overworked we are. It's Disney Orlando, and you can, and the website is quite out there. You could play a little game on the website called Bash the Boss. I'm not making this up. You go to iwantmyvacation.com and you will see this. There's a little thing where you ask the boss for a vacation, the two figures together, and you ask the boss, can I have a vacation this year? And the boss says, vacation? What do you need a vacation for? Get back to work. And then there's a little thing that's kind of going up and down, and if you click at the right time, you punch the boss, and you actually score by how many doorways down the hall you can bash the boss. You know, this is Disney doing it. So the second one,
which is also a big corporation.
Yeah, it's very, very funny, and then one wonders how much time Disney gives its own people. But the next one carries it a little bit further, and this time it's a pharmaceutical executive with RX and the whole bit. And he says, on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry of America, I would like to thank you, the American workforce, for working so long and so hard that you're all stressed out and burnt out. And thanks to your efforts, our profits are through the roof. Remember, no matter how hard, no matter how bad it gets, we've got a pill for you. Then I want my vacation.com. And the third one really takes the cake, I think. The third one is at a funeral home, and it's a group of undertakers, and they are standing in front of a coffin, and one is solemnly speaking to you, and he says, on behalf of the undertakers of America, I would like to thank our funeral directors of America, I would like to thank you, the American workforce, for showing that you have what it takes to work yourself into the ground. Mm-hmm. And then it says, and remember, if you work yourself to death, we'll be there for you. and they smile. And this is pretty interesting stuff that this is on TV. That apparently Disney has found that with focus group, they spend a lot. An ad campaign like this does not come cheap. It's a very, very, very expensive proposition. So Disney has clearly found that this works in some way. Yes.
There's one little comment on old radio. They used to have the Great Gildersleeve, and they had Digby Odell, the friendly undertaker. And one of his favorite lines was, I'll be the last one to let you down.
That's good. Yes, so you...
I was just going to say, too, I saw a photo essay. A journalist went into Disneyland for a day and just took a photo shoot and put them on the website, and they're just photo after photo of just exhausted families. One after another, the lines are sitting wore out.
I'm not sure that Disney is that much of a rest from hectic standing on lines and buying overpriced junk food, and that's really...
Well, I'm not defending Disney.
That's probably your corporate sponsor for Take Back Your Time.
Yeah, well, so far they haven't offered. It seems like these various corporations do. We from time to time we get calls from advertising marketing companies that represent corporations, and they say they'd like to partner with us over something. And we're not totally averse to that if it's the right thing and such, and if they will help fund the campaign. You know, we're okay with that. We don't have a completely no. We won't touch a corporation or anything, but what usually happens when they find out a little bit more about us, because we say, sure, let's have a conversation about this and how can we do it, and these are our parameters, which are that we won't directly endorse their product, but we're happy to put them on the site as being a sponsor of us. And the first one, Perrier, came to us, and Perrier had discovered that nowadays, Americans only take 29 minutes for lunch on average, and that most Americans eat alone at their desks. So Perrier wanted to run a campaign called Take Back the Lunch Hour, part of which would be drinking Perrier. And they wanted to partner with us on this, and we were okay. We set some limits, but we thought it was kind of funny, you know, Take Back the Lunch Hour, and they would have this research data about Americans don't eat lunch anymore. But somehow, once it got on up to the top, somebody vetoed it, and we've had that happen with a few other companies. We've got a new company now, actually Behringer Wine, which is interested in a partnership, and I don't know what they're going to end up doing. But what are a few other things that people have done to give themselves more time? We've had the TV, leaving office the early, job sharing. Yes?
This isn't a technique. It's more like the canary in the mine shaft. I find that when I don't have devotions at the beginning of my day,
that my busyness addiction takes over.
How can we phrase this in four words or less?
Priority make quiet time.
Spiritual discipline.
Okay.
Morning devotions.
Okay. Let's do that.
I hate to turn that into a technique or something.
No, but the idea is to spend time to, I mean, yeah, some people meditate, some people do, yeah, those these kind of disciplines that...
The reason I'm saying this is that I think that just figuring out a bunch of techniques isn't going to change this, that it's really an addiction.
Right.
And the addiction goes a lot deeper than just some rational techniques.
Okay.
Maybe
okay.
We need a 10-step program.
Well, what I'm trying to do here is just is to try to find out things that people really have done that have been helpful to them that aren't about how I can crowd more in my life and be more efficient, but how I can cut back and really improve my life as a life. And so, yes, it's a very deep problem, but I think just to hear what some of you are doing is valuable. Yes.
One is I don't go shopping.
I mean,
never?
But when I do, I have a list and I've researched it before I go.
Okay.
So I know where I'm going and I call.
Shop with a list.
But I just simply don't go. You find you don't need it.
Or
don't
shop.
Go.
That's right. You don't see all the stuff you.
Like, and I never take my children.
Don't take your kids shopping.
No, because.
Why train them?
Good idea.
Because again, if you go into a store, you'll see because of the 50,000 things in the store, you'll always find a need for something once you see it. But if you don't go, you're simply much more simple.
Yeah, we make an awful lot of our purchases on impulse, and it's one of the arguments that I make for would make for trying to keep Walmarts out of, and things like that out of towns, is that they don't really. One of the arguments is that they help the poor because things are cheaper and people can get things cheaply. But what we actually find is that there's so much stuff and it's cheap that people go and they say, well, oh, wow, that would be neat and it's so cheap and I can just put it on plastic and it's not a big deal. So we actually find that instead of people saving money when Walmart comes into a town and having more savings and more security economically, they get deeper into debt. The opposite phenomenon occurs. Yes?
Well, it seems to me that being mainstream is making something popular. What we've done is we have a community of people that are like-minded. And so we seek out people who are like-minded who, you know, it's not okay to be overworked. It's not okay to do these specific things that create this problem. And so you kind of use this narcissistic reflection between each other in the community to change a behavior.
So, and how do you do that? I mean, you do that the way some people do for voluntary simplicity, having study circles or groups where you actually come together and talk.
It's kind of a silent thing, really. It's just we kind of move together and we have this, you know, it's not okay to not spend any time with your kids. You can see it in their eyes. You can see it between each other. It's inappropriate, you know. And so, and the group builds on itself, and it's
but
more.
But you don't talk about it.
Yeah. There's
you do talk about
there's,
it. Okay.
You know, there's you know fringes, and it's kind of a lifestyle, you know.
Yeah, I think you just. That's my husband, so I'm part of the same group he's talking about. I think one of the things that happens is we just be upfront about it and talk about it, that this is a priority for us to spend time with family and not be overcome by our jobs. And that's, you know, beginning the change is just being able to talk about it with people that are around you.
But it makes a difference having the support of those other
yeah,
people.
Yeah, and then you learn other people, yeah, I'd like that to be the way we live as well, you know, and, you know, what can we do to do that?
Learning to set limits or to say no is a huge thing to save time. That's the hardest thing for me, I think, is learning to say no.
And what kinds of things are you learning to say no to?
For instance, I have two part-time jobs. One of them is a place where the work ethic, I stand out like a sore thumb because I work with people who cannot imagine what else they would do with their time other than work. And it's their life. And they work a lot. And they don't really take vacations. And so I stand out at that job by voluntarily working part-time, for one thing. And it's hard because there's a pressure there, a cultural pressure to work more. And the other thing, my other part-time job is I'm a kind of an independent contractor, I'm a high school sports and college sports official. And that I have more control over. I can say no to assignments, but that's hard to do because there's also a culture there of working as many games as, you know, you are asked to do so that you can advance through the ranks of the officiating world, you know, to do the better games or whatever. So I think it's just learning to set limits and say no, which is really hard for some people.
Any other, what about with your, I mean, what do people do to try to make more time for family? What are some of the things that people have thought about?
I'm trying to slowly, I can't say I've succeeded, but just clear our house of stuff. I used to, when the kids were little, go to garage sales and gather all those puzzles and games and thinking having that stuff around. But you know, the more stuff you own, you have to take care of it, you have to clean it, you have to put it away, you have to maintain it, you know, all of that, from taking care of your cars that break down to taking care of all the things. And we try hard to take care of all the stuff. And little things like realizing, you know, my kids do fine with, you know, two pairs of jeans and one pair of shorts, and that way they have room in their drawer, they can find it, and I'm just like going through their rooms, just sweeping.
So decluttering is it.
Because that stuff and life. And to be honest, we still have, you know, tons of videotapes, tons of, you know, there's things that, but I do feel our society, that's just, that's what's so overwhelming, just that you can spend your whole Saturday just taking care of stuff.
Yes, Richard Swenson calls that possession overload. That, well, everything I own owns me. And so it's kind of the balance that we do. Any of you done things to make sure that, particular things to guarantee that you will have specific family time? Have any of you done things to change, for instance, children's schedules? Anyway, any of those things. Yes, Renita.
Well, Michael and I both are pastors, and I work with students. He works in Congregation. So evenings get filled up pretty quickly, so we've said Friday evening is a time that is sacred. It's our Sabbath because he has worship on Sunday morning, so we can't have Sunday as a Sabbath time. But we've said Friday night, we always set aside, we go out for supper and often head out to a movie or a theater or something. It's a time when we don't plan anything else, and often Saturday morning is part of that as well.
What day is that again?
Oh no.
I'm so guilty.
Set aside specific time.
For a recommitment to that?
Without scheduling all kinds of other things. How many people really make it a point to try as much as possible to be sure that you have family dinners together? How many people find that difficult to do? It's very, very, very important. There's a long-term University of Michigan study, for example, that looked at what was the best predictor of how well students would do in college. And you would think that it might be the test scores or what school they went to or all of these kind of things. Guess what they came up with?
Family dinners.
Yep.
Well,
The best single predictor of how well students would do in college is whether they regularly had dinner with their families.
As an indicator of family support, perhaps.
Yeah, involvement, I think, and all of those kinds of things.
The addiction at work is that there's so much pressure to take on more responsibilities, and it seems like the more responsibilities you take on, the more you get. Mm-hmm. And you end up being the person that people go to when they need something to get done, which is kind of what you want to be when you're trying to, you know, be successful at work. But it's daunting because you end up always being the person that people go to at 4:30 in the afternoon when they need something for a 7:30 a.m. meeting, and you know, it's just.
Is it possible to resist that? Have you found ways to resist that?
No.
Anybody who asks?
I'd like to.
I mean, how do you do it? Yes.
Well, this wasn't per se work, but I was an over-volunteerer, you know, and to the point where I kind of realized after about 4 years of just going from one big project to the next of realizing, wow, you know, what is this costing my family and me? And so I just learned a mantra, which was people would ask, and I know in a work situation, you're right there face to face, it's not as easy, but I would say, you do the positive first, you know, thanks so much for asking me, you know, and that sounds interesting, and I'm going to have to check my calendar and get back to you, and that gave me the buffer that I couldn't do, you know, I was all, yeah, sure, you know, I can do that, and that buffer gave me time to think about it, and I would usually take an hour or two, or maybe even 24 hours to really think about what I was going to get out of it, and could I do it, and I know you can't really do that in work, but you could have a phrase that gave you, I'm right in the middle of something, give me 10 minutes, I got to let you know whether I can do it, I don't know.
And when it's someone who's asking you who's has a higher authority than you do, or you're trying to impress, and your ability to say no to them is just so limited. And it's not just work. It's, you know, a year and a half ago, I was asked to be on church council. And I said, it's only one evening a month, which was just a lie. It was bearing false witness. It was. And now, a year and a half later, I find myself vice president of the council. I'm on three different committees. I spend about 10 hours a week at church. And because I'm vice president, two or three different people have asked me if I'm going to be president next year. And I've just flat out said no. And, you know, I don't need this. Church has become very unworshipful over the last year and a half. Because I've learned all these terrible things about our congregation that I don't want to know.
I don't know if do we want to go there?
The company I worked for had alarm systems, see, and they told me they had a list of people available in case something happened. They would contact these people. And I was getting an awful lot of calls times during the night, and I wondered, man, what happened? Well, it turns out that list of people available was one. That was me.
Oh. There you go.
See, so it got to be kind of old after a while, but.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I retired.
That'll do it. I think we don't need any more advice here. Let's just all retire tomorrow.
One of the things I found at work, when you get good at something, people tend to come to you. After a while, I figured out, well, if they're coming to me because I know more, sometimes what I would do is, instead of saying, oh, I'll do it for you, which means another chunk of time, would be to talk it through with them using what I know, to like use the wisdom you have instead of doing it with your hands. In other words, you know, can they solve it differently? Can they do it? Can they get someone else? What's going wrong? But talk it through with what your knowledge tells you versus the actual doing of it. In other words, it's much less time to give knowledgeable advice than it is to take on the project itself. Because I think when people ask others to do it, it's their first way of solving the problem themselves. But if you go through it with them themselves, often they'll come up with another solution. So you're often the easiest option. But I tend to get them to go to the second option, which may be a different way of solving the same problem. And it didn't take up my whole night.
Okay. I want to come back for a second to this point that I made about taking time for a second to tell people that I need time to consider this. It's one of the suggestions that's made, especially to where I've read a number of places now where children's activities are involved. When you're asked, will your kid be on this team or do this or this or this or this activity, to be sure to give it a day, not to come up with an immediate answer and to think about that, because we really do kind of. How many of you deal with this issue of how to solve problems with kids' schedules and demands on kids?
I don't anymore, but I did. I was home with, we made the choice to live on one income so I could be home, stay home mom, but at one point I went back to work, and at that point we shared chores at home. I mean, everybody had, a job they had to do, and we'd turn the wheel every week so that 7-year-old's chore wouldn't get done as well as I would do it, but, it rotated through, and everybody had a night to cook, so,
And you're still here today?
Yep, we have French toast or something she could cook, and yeah, it was great. But I think sometimes we try to have, especially small families, one child or two, you got to get it all in, and those kids, so anything they want to do, they might play two sports at once, or and be in scouts, and confirmation, and all this stuff, they might have something almost every night. I think having to make choices isn't a bad thing, Focus your energy into one or two things rather than everything, so that you can maintain some sanity, and also you're teaching your children to multitask and do all these crazy things that's making you crazy, so.
One suggestion I read from the Massachusetts Council of Churches, which has been involved with this, and I want to talk about that before we finish today, is to deliberately actually schedule unstructured time for your. You may have to do that, but schedule unstructured time for children, because they're losing it in a big way. Kids today have only about half as much outdoor unstructured time as they did a generation ago. And what's one of the reasons why most families feel like they want that, they need to do that they need to schedule so much about their kids' lives? What do we hear as reasons for that?
Safety.
Safety is a big one.
Safety is.
I remember when we were kids, we were allowed to go out, and we just went out and we did who knows what we were doing. But now, we don't feel as confident about letting kids just go for hours unsupervised outdoors. It's just, it's busy. It's, you don't know where they are or what they're doing or who's interacting with them.
What are your biggest fears for the kids? These days, how do you see it as being different now than when you were a kid? What would be your biggest safety fears?
Predators.
Predators of all sorts. Okay.
Yep. Run over by drugs.
Pardon?
Traffic.
If it's interesting. If we actually look at what's happening out in the world today, traffic is a good reason. We have to be very careful about that. The streets are busier. The speed. Predators actually, the numbers don't add up at all. In fact, crimes against children today are lower than they were a generation ago. But we get a lot more attention to them in the media, and especially as we watch a lot of TV. I think we find that people who watch TV regularly overestimate the rate of crime by about 10 times compared to people who do not, because they're seeing it all the time. Yes.
When you said predators of all types. What that means to me is more than just the molesters. Drug dealers, people who are, in a sense, selling a lifestyle that's dangerous mm-hmm. to the children, not just the narrow version of predators that we often think of. And I don't know what the numbers on that are, but certainly
even that, in most communities, and there are certain communities where that's a huge problem, particularly inner city communities, but in most communities today, even the issue of drugs is lower frequency than it might have been in 1980 for people, but we don't we often don't see that. So it's a balancing act certainly. Yes.
I was just going to say one tragic example of how we think about abductors and predators. This summer, I don't remember where it was, somewhere out east, where that some children were playing. The mother went inside to do something real quick, came out a couple minutes later. The kids were gone, and immediately they thought they had been abducted. They had a big search, and then too late, they found them in the trunk of a car. Nobody was thinking that they might be hiding or something like that.
Oh, and that's the kids who died from the
heat. They died in the car.
It was in New Jersey.
The car was right there in the yard. And had they thought about what are kids thinking, how do kids think, where might they be, they thought immediately that they'd been taken. Everybody thought that. Police, everybody.
Yes.
I think this coincides with the fact that kids are overscheduled, so your kid may want to play out in the neighborhood, but they may find peers either at daycare or mm-hmm. activity. So I think the general culture has gotten more structured, mm-hmm. which does make it hard when you want to sort of go against that. So I think forming these small, you know, sort of subcultures really does support that.
Yeah, one thing that we've just started doing, a friend and his kids would show up at our house at 7 a.m. on Saturday and start cooking in our kitchen. And we'd come out and you
probably
know,
you
and,
all have, right?
And pitch in, and you know, we'd have pancakes and eggs, and the kids would play. And it actually has turned into a kind of a really nice thing that's become pretty regular. And there's like three or four other families, and it's like, where's breakfast this weekend? And we have either Saturday or Sunday morning, you know, an early breakfast get together, and you know, the family still then have the day to go do what they want to do that day, and but the kids just have unstructured playtime, and parents, we cook and eat.
What a great idea. And you don't try to stay up too late on Friday.
No, generally we're a group that goes to bed fairly early.
One of the things about, you know, kids being on a lot of different sports teams and the pressures of that, especially as they get older, I think that there is an element, and I don't have kids, but again, like I said, I officiate high school sports, so I'm kind of around that culture, that your kid is going to get a scholarship to go to college for free, and so there is a lot of pressure on kids to learn to play, to excel at a sport, which takes a lot of time. And then that, you know, in certain sports, it's more than just getting a scholarship to go to college. It's, you could become a professional athlete. Mm-hmm. And so I think our culture has evaluated athletics and professional athletes to such a degree that secretly everyone wants their kid to sign the, you know, $30 million baseball contract, and you know, yeah, like winning the lottery,
yeah.
Exactly. And that's about what it's like too. The percentages of people that go on to be, you know, professional athletes compared to the numbers that play sports as children is like a fraction of a percent.
No, it's absolutely true. One of the one of the suggestions that you might try is another one that my friend Cecile Andrews, the simplicity guru-ess or whatever you call that, says, her idea, she says, is cancel something. So she says, you know, if you look at your appointment calendar, start checking things off even if you haven't done them. I mean, it's amazing. You got this long to-do list, and just you may never know that they were there. You missed them. But the other thing she says is, you know, cancel things. For example, one day during the week, call a dinner party. Invite all your friends and say, you know, Friday evening I'm going to have a dinner party at my house. You're all welcome. Come on over. And they'll all feel like they ought to do that because you're a friend. And they may or may not want to come to the dinner party, but they'll usually say yes. In any case, then Friday morning or Friday afternoon even, call them back and say, darn, you know, something came up and I have to cancel the dinner party. Just, you know, you'll be amazed. You'll hear these one after another sighs of relief, basically. Ah, a free evening. You know, the only a free evening and no time to schedule something else in its place. So Joseph says, you know, can't cancel a meeting at work if you can. This is just giving your fellow workers pure joy. It's just one less thing.
Turn into a social coordinator.
You have to go to. Then there were still some other. I think we're getting near the end here, but there were a couple of other hands up still. Yeah.
Well, I've always been interested in when you're talking with people and they're telling you their problems of how stressed they are. When you're hearing it, it's very easy to say, well, it's simple to solve that. You know, you have to cancel some of this, but they can't see it, or like yourself, I can't see it. I have to step out of myself almost and say, oh yeah, you should cancel. You're way overloaded.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah, uh-huh.
It seems like that no matter what the program you try to work, you have to accept the possibility that you're going to fail. Family life or everything.
True. That's, yeah, and it doesn't necessarily make you any more likely to succeed if you keep doing more and more and more in order to achieve perfection either, right? Is there, yes?
At a previous session this summer, one woman said that what you're doing is important, but it's not everything. And that's just important to remember. Kind of what you said reminded me of that. It's important, but it's not everything.
Some of the other things that communities are starting to do and that you might think about, I definitely recommend, we've had this wonderful partnership over the last 2 years with the Massachusetts Council of Churches, and this poster is one that they make available to all their member churches. They have about 2,000, well, more than that, I think. I don't know how many denominations, but it's a Protestant denominations, Greek Orthodox, Unitarian, and others in the state of Massachusetts, and they've gotten very involved in the Take Back Your Time campaign. And they promoted what they call the four windows of time idea, and have encouraged through the churches people to pick 4 days between Labor Day and Take Back Your Time Day, which is 6-7 week period between roughly the 5th of September and the 24th of October, and actually set those times aside as times where you're just going to be with the family schedule, nothing, no sports. No specific kinds of activities, and they've been promoting a lot of these things through the churches and through the congregations, and I definitely recommend. They have wonderful materials on their website, which is masscouncilofchurches.org. You can see that up here. They have all kinds of materials about finding more family time, about trying to control youth sports. Particularly, they're concerned about the increasing scheduling of youth sports on Sunday mornings and things of that sort. So they also have lots of tips for individuals. They say that since they have done this, it's been the most popular activity that the council has done. Diane Kessler, who's the executive director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches, has said that this Take Back Your Time campaign has been the most popular thing that and most well-received thing that the Mass Council of Churches has done in the 20 years that she's been with the council, that they get such a response from the member churches and the people about how how helpful this has been and how people actually really come together and talk about these things and figure out how they can help each other. So I certainly suggest that you take a look at some of their materials. It really also connects, their materials also really connect the issue to the Bible, to our religious tradition, and so forth. So finally, time's up here, but tomorrow, the last session, we're going to look a little bit at the bigger kind of picture of public policy and look a little bit about what's being done these days in the rest of the world, what some of the things are that we might possibly do here, and how we could make the case that these changes would be useful. So I invite you to come and participate in that and add your suggestions. It's a great group because everybody here, I think, really has something to say and something to contribute. Any final questions or comments
just
before we...
Just a reminder that the forum is going to be tonight at 8 p.m. here in the same room, and it's pretty much dovetailing with what John DeGraff was talking about this week in terms of how do we measure happiness and trying to create a happiness index. And so please come and give your ideas.
Thank you for setting me up here. One of the things that we're finding now is that modern science is really... confirming what all of our great religious traditions have been saying all the time. So they're now really studying it. In psychology, there's been a shift. Psychology in the U.S. has traditionally been about what's wrong with people, what makes them do the wrong thing, why are they neurotic, why are they psychotic, why do they have all these problems, and increasingly, psychologists are starting to ask questions about, well, why are we going at it from this standpoint? Why don't we ask the question about what makes happy people happy? What are the elements that go into that? When we take healthy personalities and things like that, what is it that goes into making people that way? And how can our behavior and our public policies and our cultural values be shaped in a direction that will make people less neurotic, less psychotic, happier all around? And clearly all of this science, which is a lot of it, Time Magazine, January 17th issue, The Science of Happiness, looking at the findings that all of these studies are creating, they're absolutely confirming what I think our religious traditions have said, that it's not about money and stuff, that it's about family and friends and those kind of things. So we've got this. Some people seem to need this expert.
When you hold
support.
Up that Time magazine, it just occurred to me that symbol of happiness, that smiley face that's been around for probably 30 years or so, sometime in the 70s. That symbol has been stolen by Walmart as the price chopper guy.
Oh, yeah.
What makes us happy is lower prices. Walmart.
Oh, Jesus.
Right? So you've seen those, the guy with the chainsaw that cuts the prices? It's the smiley face.
Yeah. Always lower prices. Always. Right. That's true.
I don't know the history of that symbol, but...
I suppose even the Nike swoosh is kind of like that. A smile. I could put a couple of thoughts on top of that. But I encourage you to come to the forum. I think Renita is going to have a great session for us as we kind of talk about what makes us happy and how we can be happier. And maybe we'll all sing, "The more we get together, the happier we'll be." Now, how many of you know that song? It's a little terrible. Because that song has now been proven to be true by modern science. So it's confirmed. You can actually sing that song now and know that, in fact, that this has been justified by expert
even for introverts
information. Even for what do you think? You're not an introvert. Okay, thank you all.